repeated her question. Then, Sarah recalled, with a curious little gesture that combined entreaty with a suggestion of impatience, he clasped his hands in front of him and exclaimed, "Oh, for freedom!" Worried that her rules and regulations were cramping her son's spirit, she proposed a day without rules, so he could meander the estate as he chose. Straight away, she reported, quite of his own accord, he went contentedly back to his routine. "We never subjected the boy to a lot of unnecessary don'ts," Sarah maintained. "We were never strict for the sake of being strict. In fact, we took a secret pride in the fact that Franklin never seemed to require that kind of handling." If the young boy's independence was compromised by the protective care of both his parents, if there was little of the spontaneous explorations that enlivened Theodore's childhood, the disposition and temperament of Franklin Roosevelt would bear the indelible stamp of his optimistic spirit. A general expectation that things would turn out happily, testament to the immense self-confidence developed during this perfectly balanced time of his life. Roosevelt's ability in later years to adapt to changing circumstances, to alter his behavior and attitudes to suit new conditions, proved vital to his leadership success. Adaptability was forced upon him at the age of 8, when the tranquil world of Springwood was shaken to the core. In November 1890, Mr. James suffered the heart attack that left him essentially an invalid for the remaining decade of his life, and forever disrupted the family equilibrium. The outdoor activities the father and son had shared were necessarily curtailed, pulling Franklin and his mother into a conspiracy to keep the father's life untroubled, free from anxiety. Ever after, Franklin's innate desire to placate, to mollify, and to please by being a very nice child was intensified by the fear that if he appeared sad or troubled, he might be responsible for damaging further his father's heart. When a steel curtain rod fell on him, producing a deep gash on his scalp line, Franklin insisted that his father not be told. For days, he simply pulled his hat down over his forehead to hide the wound. The need to navigate the altered dynamic of Springwood required new measures of secrecy, duplicity, and manipulation, qualities that would later prove troubling, but were at this juncture benign, designed only to protect a loved one from harm. Consequently, in the absence of his father's companionship, and with the lack of nearby playmates, Franklin spent more and more time inside the house, devoting hours each day to what became an impressive assembly of collections. Stamps, maps, model ships, birds' nests, coins, naval prints. His stamp collection came to be his central hobby. Sarah started him off with the collection she had built up as a child, and then his uncle, Frederick Delano, seeing how earnestly the boy pursued his hobby, gifted Franklin with his own valuable collection. In an essay on the nature of genuine collectors, Walter Benjamin suggests that collecting is a way of ordering a disordered world. He notes that collecting holds a special meaning for children, offering a small corner of the world where the child is in charge, experiencing the thrill of acquisition and the pride that comes with unifying and mastering a hodgepodge of assorted items. The quiet time Franklin spent each day poring over stamp catalogs, selecting and arranging his stamps into albums, furnished a haven, a protected space where he could be on his own, free from the demands of a mother who had developed an increasing dependence on her son in the aftermath of her husband's diminished state. Mr. James had been their protector. Together, she and her son were now responsible for protecting him. Roosevelt's childhood hobbies would serve in later years as invaluable tools nourishing his leadership. providing a meditative state, a space in which he could turn things over in his mind, the means by which he could relax and replenish his energy. On a visit with Roosevelt during World War II, Winston Churchill recalled sitting by the president's side one evening as Roosevelt sorted and arranged his stamps, placing each one in its proper place, forgetting the cares of state. Roosevelt's secretary, Grace Tully, recalled the feeling of calm that invariably descended on her whenever she saw her boss, a magnifying glass in hand, Scott's stamp catalog, scissors, and packages of stickers. For she knew that for a short period of time at least, he could escape the problems that beset him. Compared to the philosophical and poetic depths of Lincoln's mind, or the scintillating breadth of Theodore's intelligence, Franklin's intellect might seem, as it did to Oliver Wendell Holmes, second rate. That presumption is seriously misleading. An uncommon intuitive capacity and interpersonal intelligence allowed him as a child to read the intentions and desires of his parents, to react appropriately to shifting household moods, gifts that he would nurture and develop in the years ahead. While he did not learn as a fledgling academic often does, by mastering vast reading material and applying analytical skills, he possessed an incredibly shrewd, complicated, problem-solving intelligence, coupled with a supple and often jaunty verbal capacity. All his life, Franklin learned more from listening than from reading in solitude. He was able to absorb great quantities of information by hearing people talk. When he was young, his mother regularly read to him. One night, Sarah recalled, she was reading to him while he lay sprawled on his tummy sorting and pasting his beloved stamps. Thinking that he was not listening, she put the book down. "I don't think there is any point in my reading to you anymore," she said. "You don't hear me anyway." He looked up, a whimsical smile on his face, and quoted verbatim the last paragraph of the essay. With a mischievous glint in his eye, he said, "Why, Mom, I would be ashamed of myself if I couldn't do at least two things at once." Years later, Roosevelt told his cabinet secretary, Francis Perkins, that as he grew older, he much preferred to read aloud to someone than to read by himself. "There was something incurably sociable about this man," she observed. "He was sociable in his intellectual as well as his playful moods." Instead of reading documents or memos, White House counselor and speechwriter Sam Rosenman observed Roosevelt generally preferred to get his information orally. He could interrupt and ask questions. It was easy for him to get the gist right away. In contrast to the vigorous education Thee had given Theodore and his siblings both at home and during their sojourns abroad, Franklin's education was casual and haphazard. A series of governesses tutored him in childhood, but even this intermittent instruction was interrupted by three lengthy stays in Europe, where James and Sarah sought the healing powers of mineral spas at Bad Nauheim in Germany. Focused entirely on restoring his health, James could not take his son on the expeditions to battlefields and famous literary landscapes that Thee had chosen to enliven both history and literature for his children. Franklin attended a local German school for a short time, where his acutely receptive ear allowed him to pick up the German language with remarkable ease. When Franklin turned 12, Mr. James wrote to Endicott Peabody, headmaster at the Groton School, asking if he could recommend a gentleman tutor who could also be my boy's companion. Mr. James finally found the young man he wanted in Arthur Dumper, a Latin and mathematics master at St. Paul's Prep School. Franklin, Arthur Dumper later remarked, went about learning in a curiously unorthodox manner. He preferred to engage his tutor in conversation, talking over what he was learning, spending more time with his stamps than with his books. Through that passionate interest in stamps, however, Franklin assimilated a great deal of knowledge, cobbling together bits and pieces of information to form a complicated tissue of associated interests. Each stamp told a story, beginning with the place and date of issue, the image represented on the front, postmarks providing the time and location of its travels, stories as alive in Franklin's fantasy life as the adventure tales of James Fenimore Cooper had been for Theodore Roosevelt, or Aesop's fables for Abraham Lincoln. Sarah's original collection had been assembled during her family's protracted sojourn in Asia. Other stamps came from Europe, still others from South America. When asked years later how he had gained such familiarity with obscure places in the world, Roosevelt explained that when he became interested in a stamp, it led to his interest in the issuing country. Digging through the encyclopedia, he would learn about the country, its people, and its history. Finding words he didn't understand, he carried Webster's unabridged dictionary to bed at night, at one point telling his mother he was almost halfway through. He was learning in his own way, revealing a unique transverse intelligence that cut naturally across categories, a characteristic mode of problem-solving, and a practical mastery of detail that would last a lifetime. A fascination with maps and atlases developed next, fixing in his mind an astonishing range of facts about the topography of countries, the rivers, mountains, lakes, valleys, natural resources, information that would prove invaluable when he was called upon in future years to explain to his countrymen how and where two wars would envelop the entire world. Franklin's ability to adapt to changing circumstances was put to a punishing test when he was sent to boarding school at Groton at the age of 14. Most boys started at 12, but Sarah, unable to part with him, had kept him back for 2 years. "The other boys had formed their friendships," Franklin later told Eleanor. "They knew things he didn't. He felt left out." Unaccustomed to the ordinary give-and-take of schoolmates, the studied charm and mannered gentility that had impressed adults struck fellow students as stilted, foppish, affected, insincere. Nor did he possess the athleticism to shine or even participate in varsity team sports. He later confessed that he felt hopelessly out of things. He fiercely desired to be popular, but had no idea how to court the favor of his fellow students, mistakenly assuming that he would be respected if he had no black marks for minor infractions. Never once, however, did the lonely boy divulge his true feelings to his mother. On the contrary, in a string of cheerful letters, he insisted he was adjusting splendidly, both mentally and physically, that he was getting on very well with the fellows, receiving good marks in his classes. Sarah was relieved and thrilled. She had feared that arriving so late he might be seen as an interloper. But almost overnight, she proudly noted, he became sociable and gregarious and entered with the frankest enjoyment into every kind of school activity. The image he projected was meant to placate his mother, but also to hearten himself, blurring the distinction between things as they were and things as he wished them to be. The ingrained expectation that things would somehow turn out positively allowed him to move steadily forward, to adjust and persevere in the face of difficulty. And in time, he found his own niche as a member of the debate team. In keeping with Groton's mission to educate young men for public service, all students were required to participate in debates before an audience. Franklin prepared hard and long for each of his debates, asking his father for advice, information, and pointers. His excellent memory put him in good stead, allowing him to speak directly to the audience without notes. Unlike Theodore Roosevelt, who shunned debating societies, believing they encouraged insincerity by training young men to take a position counter to their own feelings and beliefs, Franklin enjoyed considering an issue from different points of view, demonstrating a persuasive reasoning to express whatever side he was given. He connected emotionally with his audience and reveled in victory. Over 30 votes were cast, out of which our opponents received 3, he gloated to his parents. I think it is about the biggest beating that has been given this year. He began to relax more with his classmates, and by his final year, he had made some good friends. Though failing to distinguish himself in his academic studies, he achieved high scores on the entrance examinations for Harvard, making his parents immensely proud. Nonetheless, these accomplishments did little to mark him as a leader among his schoolmates. It was not until the end of his first year at Groton that he realized how little he gained from being a well-behaved, well-mannered young man. I have served off my first black mark today for talking in class, and I am very glad I got it, he told his parents, as I was thought to have no school spirit before. 3 decades later, after Roosevelt's election as president in 1932, Headmaster Endicott Peabody observed, "There's been a good deal written about Franklin Roosevelt when he was a boy at Groton, more than I should have thought justified by the impression that he left at school. He was a quiet, satisfactory boy of more than ordinary intelligence, taking a good position in his form, but not brilliant. Athletically, he was rather too slight for success." Ostensibly accurate, such an assessment failed to recognize that upon his entry to Groton, the cosseted young boy had never experienced the jostle of relationships with boys his own age. He had been accorded the center of attention wherever he went, simply by being Franklin Roosevelt. Not yet a leader of the boys, not even accepted as one of the boys, he was learning to project a confident good cheer, to mask his frustrations, which, at this stage of his development, was a great achievement in itself. The ambitious striving for achievement that had served as powerful catalysts to both Abraham Lincoln and Theodore Roosevelt was not visible in Franklin Roosevelt's behavior when he entered Harvard College. In later years, when Sarah was asked if she ever imagined that her son might become president, she replied, "Never. No, never. That was the last thing I should ever have imagined for him, or that he should be in public life of any sort." Both she and her son, she insisted, shared a far simpler ambition. It might even be thought not very ambitious, but to me and to him too, it was the highest ideal. To grow to be like his father, straight and honorable, just and kind, an upstanding American. Sarah could not fathom that her 18-year-old son was beginning to form dreams of his own, visions of a life beyond that of a country squire who would lead a regular seasonal existence, managing the estate, summering in Campobello, dabbling in local affairs. Beneath his insouciant exterior, the young man who had held center stage the first decade of his life harbored desires to replicate that experience in the world at large, to accomplish something worthy of attention. During his first semester at Harvard, the elements that had held Franklin's life in compliant balance careened out of joint when his father suffered a fatal heart attack. Suddenly, Franklin was forced to take stock of his position, desires, and ambitions. The college student was now expected to be the man of the family. He had already developed a profound, reciprocally dependent bond with his mother. Without the focus and buffer of the father-husband, they were alone together, unable to bear the unthinkable idea of living by herself at Hyde Park. Sarah rented a townhouse in Boston to be near her son. She was an indulgent mother, observed a family friend, but would not let her son call his soul his own. Franklin's quest to achieve autonomy without wounding his mother required new levels of manipulation, nimbleness, and guile, a deeper resourcefulness, persistence, and willfulness, self-preserving qualities he would add to his developing capacities. For the first time, he began to chart his own course, seeking a place where he could shine on his own, free from parental imposition and expectation. He found that place at the Harvard Crimson. He began at the lowest level, one of 70 freshmen vying for a position on the staff. "The competition was tough," a classmate recalled. "The drain on the candidate's thought and time exhausting." The challenge demanded his full attention, providing legitimate reasons to decline his mother's constant invitations for dinner or the theater. He worked harder than he had ever worked before, harder than he did on his studies, where he settled into a gentleman's C average. "My dearest mummy," he wrote, "I am working about 6 hours a day on the Crimson alone, and it is quite a strain." Though he failed to make the first group of 5 freshmen selected in February, he refused to give up. A combination of luck, initiative, boldness, and privilege opened the door 2 months later. After reading in the Boston newspapers that Theodore Roosevelt, who was then vice president, was coming into town, he contacted his famous relative to see if they could get together. Franklin had met Theodore a number of times during family outings at Oyster Bay. He had reveled in the stories Roosevelt told at a Groton Chapel lecture about his days as police commissioner, stories that kept the whole room in an uproar for an hour. Having developed a special fondness for Franklin, Theodore arranged to meet him directly after his guest lecture, scheduled for Professor Lawrence Lowell's class the following morning. The lecture, intended only for the students in the class, had not been made public. Franklin hurried to the Crimson to break the news. "Young man," the managing editor told him, "you hit page 1 tomorrow morning." Professor Lowell was livid when the front page article brought 2,000 people clamoring to get into the hall. But Theodore Roosevelt, never one to slight publicity, took it in stride. Weeks later, Franklin was elected to join the Crimson staff. Flush with his first electoral success, a more independent Franklin wrote his mother as summer approached, "I don't want to go to Campo. Neither do you. It would be too sad." Instead, he suggested a trip abroad. "We both will enjoy seeing new places and new things, and it will quite take us out of ourselves." Landing back in New York in September, they learned that President William McKinley had been assassinated, and that cousin Theodore Roosevelt was now President of the United States. Returning to Harvard, Franklin slowly worked his way up the Crimson ladder. His sophomore year, he was elected secretary, then assistant managing editor, then managing editor, and finally, his senior year, to editor-in-chief of the newspaper. Franklin's ascent at the Crimson was such a landmark in his developing sense of himself as a leader that he chose to take graduate courses in order to extend his position at the paper's helm. While many of his editorials reflected typical college concerns with flagging school spirit and athletics, in one revealing piece, he recommended that students interested in politics would learn more in one day by venturing into Boston to observe ward politics. "The machinery of primary, caucus, convention, election and legislature," than by listening to abstract lectures on government. Though he had read Kant and a little of Rousseau, he confessed that in neither philosopher had he found the decisive leader. Experience, he believed, was the best teacher. Roosevelt would look back in later years with prideful nostalgia on this first leadership position. Much as Abraham Lincoln considered his first election as captain in the Black Hawk War, the success that had given him more pleasure than any other in his life. While a few fellow editors found Franklin conceited and cocky, more self-assured than his writing skills deserved, the majority agreed that he was quick-witted and capable as an editor, and a very good companion with an optimistic spirit and an infectious sense of humor. "There were traits of his which, as one looks back on them, become significant," one colleague recalled. "He had a force of personality. He liked people, and he made them instinctively like him. Moreover, in his geniality, there was a kind of frictionless command." At Groton, he had managed to survive. At Harvard, he had begun to thrive. The first hint of a signature component of what would characterize Franklin Roosevelt's fundamental style, the ability to make decisions without hesitating or looking back, coupled with a propensity to keep the process of determination hidden from view, emerged during his clandestine courtship of Eleanor Roosevelt. Early on, Franklin had sensed and been wary of even the appearance of competition between his interest in other girls and his mother's love. In letters and conversation, he would exhaustively share with his mother details of his daily activities, skillfully omitting his innermost feelings, the intimacies she might consider a trespass upon the primacy of their own relationship. In the wake of his father's death, that need for concealment intensified. No one, not a single friend, and surely not his mother, knew that he had fallen in love with his plain cousin Eleanor in the spring of his junior year at Harvard. They had been together at horse races, house parties, sailing trips, dances, and family events. But Sarah had no inkling they shared other than a friendship when, the following Thanksgiving, Franklin delivered the shocking news. He had asked Eleanor to marry him. She had accepted. "I know what pain I must have caused you, and you know I wouldn't do it if I really could have helped it," he wrote Sarah after returning to Harvard. "I know my mind, have known it for a long time, and know that I could never think otherwise. Result, I am the happiest man just now in the world. Likewise, the luckiest. And for you, dear mummy, you know that nothing can ever change what we have always been and always will be to each other. Only now you have two children to love, and to love you." In saying that he knew his mind, had known it for a long time, and could never think otherwise, Franklin declared that his decision was not up for discussion. His mother recognized this conclusiveness. As would be true the rest of his life, once he made a decision, he rarely second-guessed himself. In the end, he had sought his own counsel until the inner struggle between filial devotion and love for Eleanor had been resolved. Thereafter, he refused to squander energy by raking over and re-examining whether he had made the right choice. He would marry Eleanor, and that was that. He would always love his mother. His identity and future course were the issues at stake here. Eleanor was unlike any girl Franklin had met. She was highly intelligent, free from affectation, deeply absorbed in social causes, wholly uninterested in the privileged world of debutante balls. Eleanor's early years had been as fraught with sorrow as Franklin's were filled with joy. She was 8 when her mother Anna died from diphtheria, and 10 when her father Elliot, Theodore Roosevelt's younger brother, died gruesomely from alcoholism. When she began seeing Franklin, however, she had just returned from 3 triumphant years at a girls' boarding school in England. At Allenswood, she had started a new life, free from the conventions and traditions of her social class. basking in the maternal love of the legendary feminist headmistress, Mademoiselle Marie Silvestre, Eleanor became everything in the school, the most popular and respected student among faculty and students alike. "She is full of sympathy for all those who live with her," the headmistress reported to Eleanor's grandmother, "and shows an intelligent interest in everything she comes in contact with." "The surest way to be happy," Eleanor wrote in an essay at school, "is to seek happiness for others." When she returned to New York, at the urging of her headmistress, she became involved in social work, teaching classes to immigrant Italians at the Rivington Street settlement in the Lower East Side. She joined a group of female activists who were investigating working conditions in factories and department stores. "I had a great curiosity about life," she wrote, "and a desire to participate in every experience." In the subterfuge of their betrothal, Franklin and Eleanor shared their unfolding dreams to leave a mark on the world. Eleanor's social consciousness and urgent sense of social justice, the awakening of a caring for the other, a championing of the underdog, far preceded and exceeded his. He admired her distaste for the debutante world she was about to enter, her rebellious desire to find something meaningful to do. She was a serious person, and so was he, despite the feather duster impression he sometimes left. He, too, was going through a rite of passage. The life he might lead, as reflected and encouraged in Eleanor's eyes, was a life involving a broad human contact with all manner of people. One afternoon, when he picked her up from the settlement house, she enlisted his help in carrying home a young girl who had fallen ill. "My God, I didn't know anyone lived like that," he told Eleanor when they reached the decrepit tenement where the girl's family lived. He was as dumbfounded and astounded as his cousin Theodore Roosevelt had been when he witnessed the squalor in which the dwellers of the cigar tenements were forced to live. With Eleanor by his side, Franklin believed he would amount to something someday. After a weekend together in New York, Eleanor wrote, "It is impossible to tell you what these last 2 days have been to me, but I know they have meant the same to you, so that you will understand that I love you, dearest, and I hope that I shall always prove worthy of the love which you have given me. I have never known before what it was to be absolutely happy." Eleanor knew, she later said, long before Franklin's run for the state senate, that he wanted to go into politics. The impulse, she believed, had been stimulated by his admiration for her uncle, Theodore Roosevelt, whose every activity he followed with great attention. When their engagement was announced, President Roosevelt wrote Franklin, "We are greatly rejoiced over the good news. I am as fond of Eleanor as if she were my daughter, and I like you and trust you and believe in you. You and Eleanor are true and brave, and I believe you love each other unselfishly, and golden years open before you." Franklin and Eleanor went to Washington together on March 4, 1905, to celebrate Theodore Roosevelt's inauguration. Joining the inner circle at an intimate lunch, sitting with the family at the reviewing stand during the parade, and then attending the inaugural ball. 11 days later, President Roosevelt, standing in his deceased brother's place, gave the bride away. "Well, Franklin," the president said with a smile, "there's nothing like keeping the name in the family." Just as Theodore Roosevelt had recognized that when opportunity comes, a person has to take advantage of it, so Franklin, who seemed to be adrift when he entered his second year as a junior law clerk at Carter, Ledyard & Milburn, was simply waiting for the right moment to make his move. During a slack time at the office, he and his fellow clerks fell into discussion about their hopes and plans for the future. When Franklin's turn came, he disclosed that he wasn't going to practice law forever, that he intended to run for office at the first opportunity. Indeed, he had already visualized and privately rehearsed the steps that he would in all likelihood take. Election to the State Assembly would come first, leading to an appointment as Assistant Secretary of the Navy, before becoming Governor of New York, and then, with good fortune, President of the United States. No mockery greeted young Roosevelt's hypothetical ascent, despite the fact that the 25-year-old had never held a single public position. Franklin seemed proper and sincere, one fellow clerk recalled, and moreover, as he put it, entirely reasonable. After all, the career trail Franklin intended to follow was identical to the one Theodore Roosevelt had blazed to the White House. The matter-of-fact manner in which Franklin had laid out his career course explains why he immediately embraced John Mack's suggestion that he run with the party's full backing for the assembly seat from Hyde Park in Poughkeepsie. Even more revealing is Franklin's reaction when, only 5 weeks before the election, he learned that he was no longer the party's choice. The incumbent assemblyman, Lewis Chandler, had changed his mind, informing the Democratic chieftains that he had decided to retain his old seat in the assembly after all. Feeling snake-bitten, Franklin told John Mack and Edward Perkins that he had come too far to stop. He just might have to run as an independent. The local bosses responded with a counteroffer. The convention had not yet decided on a Democratic candidate for the state Senate seat, clearly a far more prestigious position. They conceded, however, that winning in the larger and mainly rural district was a long shot. Republicans, with a single exception, had held the Senate seat for almost half a century. The incumbent Republican, John Schlosser, had beaten his Democratic opponent by a 2-to-1 margin in the last election. The chances for victory, Mack surmised, were 1 in 5. But if Roosevelt wanted the nomination, he could have it. How could he be certain he would get the nomination? Franklin asked. It was made by a committee of 3, Mack replied. He was one, and he was sure of another, and quite sure of the third. I'll take it, Franklin said, with absolutely no hesitation, and I'll win the election. His immediate response revealed the decisiveness and sublime confidence that mark his mature nature. The acceptance speech he delivered after the nomination was longer than Theodore's 33-word statement, but equally devoid of content and far removed from Lincoln's substantial and poignant introductory circular. By saying he did not intend to sit still, however, he made it clear he would give his all to the campaign. From the start, Franklin had a distinct feeling that in order to win, he must put himself into direct personal touch with every available voter. The horse and wagon he had hired earlier in the summer had been sufficient when he was running for the assembly, but the 3-county Senate district was 30 miles wide and 90 miles long. Furthermore, only 5 weeks remained before the election. As he thought the problem over, he devised an innovative strategy. He would be the first candidate to crisscross the district in an automobile instead of a horse and buggy. Veteran advisors cautioned him. The automobile was just coming into use, Mack recalled. Get a horse, farmers jeered when passing frequent automobile breakdowns. Furthermore, Mack explained, horses were terrified of the new contraption, and when meeting one on the highway would bolt, frequently upsetting the farmer's wagon with occasional injuries. Despite such hazards, the idea of breaking precedent captivated Franklin, as it would again and again in the years ahead. Locating a driver and a splashy red Maxwell touring car, he invited two fellow Democrats running for different offices to accompany him on what turned into a rollicking circus-like adventure. People were drawn to the sight of the newfangled gadget, festooned with flags and campaign banners, traversing the rough country roads at a startling speed of 20 miles per hour. Meanwhile, Franklin turned the potential liability into an advantage. He ordered the driver to bring the car to an immediate stop whenever they encountered a horse and buggy or wagon. Such deference not only impressed the farmers, but afforded Franklin the occasion to introduce himself and shake hands. Every aspect of the barnstorming process excited Franklin. He designed his own posters and buttons, placed ads in county newspapers, and most importantly, reveled in direct contact with people. At crossroads, train stations, general stores, saloons, and front porches, he delivered short speeches, sometimes as many as 10 a day. Franklin spoke slowly then, Eleanor recalled, and every now and then there would be a long pause, and I would be worried for fear he would never go on. But he always did. And when he finished, Democratic committeeman Tom Leonard recalled, he moved easily and naturally among the crowd, flashing that smile of his, introducing himself as Frank, approaching every person as a friend. This was his first political campaign, a local politician recalled, but none of his later campaigns were entered with more will to win than was this senatorial campaign of 1910. He promised voters that if they elected him, he would be a real representative, giving his full energies to their concerns. Every day of the 365, every hour of the 24, that is my promise. I ask you to give me the chance to fill it. He pledged to return regularly to the district, traveling from one end to the other, listening to voters' concerns. Over and over, he stressed his independence, vowing to stand against the bosses in either party. "I know I'm no orator," he liked to say. "You don't have to be an orator, Roosevelt," someone in the audience yelled back. "Talk right along to us on those lines. That's what we like to hear." When the votes were tallied on election day, Franklin learned that he had vanquished his opponent, winning by the largest margin of any Democratic candidate in the state. In analyzing Roosevelt's victory, one can cite the fortuitous historical moment, the split in the Republican Party between progressives and conservatives that produced Democratic victories across the nation. One can point to the reflected glow the presidential surname lent the aspiring state senator, along with the substantial funding made possible by the family's wealth. Or summon the novelty of that red Maxwell barnstorming the country roads. But what was evident in the end was the fact that the cheerful, gregarious, disarmingly glamorous young man had outworked, out-traveled, and out-strategized the Republicans by simply listening to the hopes and needs of whoever crossed his path. Long visualized ambition and directed energy had finally brought him to the place where he wanted to be. No sooner had Franklin entered the state Senate than he charged into battle against the entrenched Tammany machine that held a grip on the state Democratic Party. Just as Theodore Roosevelt had found in Judge Westbrook a vehicle to fight corruption, so Franklin found his instrument in Tammany boss Charlie Murphy's personal choice for the United States Senate, blue-eyed Billy Sheehan, a machine politician who had made millions through collusion with the streetcar industry. Hearing that a rebel group was forming in the assembly to block Sheehan, Franklin became the first senator to sign the manifesto, pledging the insurgent band to boycott the caucus as long as it took to foil Boss Murphy's choice. Luck, the proximity of his dwelling to the assembly, which made it the perfect place for the insurgents to convene, combined with Roosevelt's personal charm and celebrated name to make the novice senator the spokesman for the 20-member group. "I never had as much fun in my life as I am having now," a beaming Roosevelt told reporters. Late at night, the esprit de corps among this fraternity was palpable. The good fellowship of his 20 comrades provided the most pleasant feature. With cigar smoke curling in the air, "We sit around and swap stories like soldiers at the bivouac fire," he said. Invigorated by the battle and emboldened by the headlines, Roosevelt refused to compromise, even after Murphy withdrew Sheehan's name. The substitute Murphy put forward, Roosevelt declared, was equally unsuitable. Francis Perkins, then an Albany social worker lobbying on behalf of unions, recalled how disagreeable and conceited young Roosevelt struck her during this period. "I can still see that Roosevelt now, standing back of the brass rail with two or three senators arguing with him to be reasonable, his small mouth pursed up and slightly open, his nostrils distended, his head in the air, and his cool, remote voice saying, 'No, no, I won't hear of it.'" Years later, Roosevelt admitted to Miss Perkins that he was an awfully mean cuss when he first entered politics. Like young Theodore, Franklin had developed a grandiose sense of his own importance, and, like his cousin, he was heading for a fall. By the end of March, nearly 3 months after the battle had begun, the ranks of the weary insurgents finally began to break. When Murphy put forth yet another name, that of Justice James Aloysius O'Gorman, a Tammany man with an independent streak, enough insurgents decided to go along to bring the battle to an end, though some critics contended that O'Gorman was no better than Sheehan. Roosevelt converted defeat into victory simply by calling it a victory, declaring that Murphy had been taught moderation and shamelessly maintaining that the party had taken an upward step. Recognizing, however, that his actual power within the chamber had dimmed, even as his political star rose brightly, Franklin began to moderate his approach. He learned, in much the same way as Theodore Roosevelt had, to work together with different factions and strike bargains. He reached out to individual Tammany members, no longer categorically assuming that all of them were corrupt. On the contrary, many of them had forged enduring ties with the common men and women in their districts, dispensing aid, jobs, and comfort, working around the clock to satisfy their constituents' immediate needs. Indeed, it was Bowery boss Big Tim Sullivan and the Tammany organization that had taken the lead in sponsoring much of the progressive social legislation that Franklin eventually supported, including workmen's compensation, the 54-hour work week, and women's suffrage. Franklin had been a quick study in learning the art of compromise in order to get things accomplished. In hindsight, the most enduring impact of the Sheehan battle lay in the fact that the widespread coverage of this young Democratic crusader against Tammany had caught the eye of the newly elected Democratic president, Woodrow Wilson. Within 2 weeks of his inauguration, Wilson offered the state senator the coveted post of Assistant Secretary of the Navy. "How would I like it?" "I'd like it bully well," an excited Roosevelt replied. "It would please me better than anything in the world. All my life I have loved ships and have been a student of the Navy, and the assistant secretaryship is the one place above all others I would love to hold." Sarah believed that her son's deep attraction to the ocean was hereditary. Her Delano grandfather had captained American clipper ships, renowned for their beauty and speed, to the Orient. As a boy, Franklin always thrilled to tales of the sea. At the age of 13, he had told his father he wanted to go to the Naval Academy in Annapolis, but Mr. James persuaded him, man to man, that it would be too hard on his parents for their only son to be away as much as a naval career would demand. While at Harvard, he had kept his interest in the Navy alive by trolling second-hand bookstores to build a collection of books and manuscripts on naval history that eventually comprised some 2,500 volumes. Little wonder that the proffered post was the one he desired above all others. Moreover, the post as Assistant Secretary of the Navy placed Franklin on the next rung on the ladder to the presidency he had uncannily visualized as a 25-year-old when he confided his vaulting ambitions to his fellow law clerks. Observers noted when the appointment was announced that he was following lockstep Theodore Roosevelt's path. Indeed, Theodore recognized the parallelism in his congratulatory note to Franklin. It is interesting that you are in another place which I myself once held. I am sure you will enjoy yourself to the full. As Assistant Secretary of the Navy, working for 7 years under Secretary Josephus Daniels, a former newspaper publisher with long experience in Democratic Party politics, Franklin had to learn for the first and last time in his political career how to operate as a subordinate. The situation proved challenging for the young man, who, despite his unfolding leadership skills, remained deficient in one essential quality, humility. Josephus Daniels, 2 decades older than Franklin and a neophyte in naval protocol and language, approached his new job tentatively. A courtly Southerner, able to swap yarns and relax with colleagues, Daniels worked with deliberation to build solid relationships with key congressmen and senators. Franklin, an activist by nature and a passionate believer in an expanded Navy ready for action in an increasingly volatile world, considered Daniels an old fuddy-duddy, who, he told Eleanor, was too damn slow for words. One evening at a dinner party, Franklin made several derogatory remarks about Daniels. You should be ashamed of yourself, Secretary of the Interior Franklin Lane cautioned. Mr. D is your superior, and you should show him loyalty or you should resign. Franklin heeded Lane's advice. He held his tongue in public, and eventually came to appreciate the great value of the warm relationships Daniels had managed to cultivate with members of the appropriations committees responsible for the Navy's funding. As Secretary of the Navy, Daniels was responsible for overall naval policy, the disposition of the fleet, and congressional relations. While Daniels handled policy, Franklin, his sole assistant secretary, was charged with administering the giant Navy Department, which employed 65,000 men with a budget representing 20% of federal expenditures. He was responsible for procuring supplies and equipment, supervising docks, Navy yards, and personnel. And beyond the daily bureaucratic tasks under his purview, he was determined to move the entrenched bureaucracy forward, to build bigger and better equipped ships, and to reorganize the work of the civilian personnel to strengthen the Navy's readiness for battle should the necessity arise. What enabled this 31-year-old with virtually no management experience to meet the double challenge of administering the department he inherited while initiating a transformative process of moving it forward in a different direction? To be sure, having the vision to know where he wanted to go, to see a different future for the organization, was the essential first step. But how did he actually succeed in making it happen? And how, despite his contentious start with his superior Daniels, was he able to forge a productive working relationship and lifelong friendship that eventually benefited both men? For answers, one cannot resort solely to Franklin's celebrated first-class temperament, but rather confront the speed and rule-bending originality of his intellect, which, at work within a complex organizational arena for the first time, proved anything but second rate. All his life, people had underestimated, and would continue to misjudge, Franklin's native intelligence. The academic yardsticks used at Groton, Harvard College, and Columbia Law failed to measure his distinctive problem-solving capacity, to gauge his aptitude for seeing how disparate things connect, or to credit the quickness with which he absorbed information. These unique aspects of his mind were often camouflaged by his outward geniality and the easy charm of his demeanor, leading members of his social circle to consider him a lightweight. Those who witnessed young Roosevelt in the Navy Department, however, clearly understood they were in the presence of a striking intelligence. "A man with a flashing mind," was how one Rear Admiral described him. "It took my breath away," he said, "to see how rapidly he grasped the essentials of a situation, how thoroughly he absorbed the details of the most complicated subjects." To gain a dynamic, up-to-date picture of the size and capacity of the current fleet and the disposition of the 65,000 military and civilian personnel, Franklin had fixed to his office wall a large map of the world. Colored pins denoted the position of every ship in the fleet. Whenever a ship moved, the pins were moved. Other pins indicated the numbers of people employed at various Navy yards, docks, and supply centers, allowing him to see what was transpiring. From the start, he formed a mental image of the Navy as a living organism, rather than a moribund bureaucracy filled with dead wood. He envisioned a vast organization comprised of people working in places and working in jobs that could be grown into a Navy second to none. With a glance at his wall map, Roosevelt noted dozens of useless Navy yards, originally designed for the maintenance of sailing vessels, presently operating at great loss due to patronage and political pressure. Rather than closing these obsolete yards, he conceived of a new plan. He would convert each one into a specialized industrial plant for the manufacture of vessels and equipment needed for an expanded modern Navy. The old Brooklyn Navy Yard would specialize in radios to outfit the fleet. Ropes and anchors and chains for battleships would become the province of the Boston Yard. Cruisers would be built in Philadelphia. Submarines and destroyers in Norfolk. This new mode of reorganization gave Roosevelt a reputation as an economizer. More importantly, such consolidation was a necessary step to ready a peacetime Navy for a potential war. From the start, Roosevelt assembled a personal staff to assist him not only to manage the existing bureaucracy, but at the same time, to introduce new ideas and methods. Aware that he needed an assistant to whom he could entrust the routine aspects of the job, he kept Charles McCarthy as his private secretary. McCarthy, who had served in several previous administrations, embodied the traditions and rituals of the naval status quo. Within short order, Roosevelt secured McCarthy's respect and affection. "It is only a big man and real executive," McCarthy told Roosevelt, "who can distinguish between the minor details of such an office which you have properly left to those in whom you have had confidence, and the bigger problems which you have so ably handled yourself." Winning the veteran bureaucrat's admiration made it easier for Franklin to gain the cooperation of the traditional bureaucratic cadre as he moved to change and reform the institution. To help implement the transformative agenda of putting the Navy on a new readiness footing, Roosevelt brought in his own man, 40-year-old Lewis Howe, an outstanding reporter for the New York Herald, whose strange appearance inspired a range of hyperbolic descriptions as a gnome-like creature, a singed cat with thinning hair and luminous eyes, clothed in wrinkled suits perpetually covered with cigarette ashes. Howe had first encountered Roosevelt during the campaign to boycott Sheehan's appointment to the U.S. Senate. Such was the immediate attraction between the two men that they would become not merely the closest of friends, but indispensable to one another. Thereafter, Howe dedicated his life to Roosevelt. For the next quarter century, they seldom spent more than a couple days apart. While the genial and optimistic Roosevelt was generally averse to confrontation, Howe was tough and cynical by nature, happy to battle opposing people head-on. Never shy about his opinions, Howe could deflate Roosevelt's pride, prod his negligence, and tell him flatly when and where he had gone astray. Remaining largely behind the scenes, he let Roosevelt absorb credit when things went well, and readily accepted blame when they did not. The methods Roosevelt used to propel a sluggish bureaucracy toward a more expansive and prepared status would become his characteristic way of dealing with constraints in the years ahead. He insisted that when something had to be done, there was always a way to do it, whether it involved bypassing regulations, cutting through red tape, or breaking precedent. "He was a great trial-and-error guy," Admiral Emery Land recalled of Roosevelt during this period. "He would fling things against the wall, seeing if they would stick. If they didn't, he would acknowledge his mistake and try something else. When regulations prevented the government from selling naval guns to merchant ships, for example, he devised a scheme for loaning them with a suitable bond instead of offering them for sale, a seed that would germinate into the historic Lend-Lease program during World War II. In addition to the fertility of his imagination and the suppleness of his techniques for circumventing strictures, was his willingness at times of urgency to employ questionable means to achieve his goals. He placed official orders for millions of dollars worth of guns, supplies, and equipment prior to congressional approval of the funds. He persuaded manufacturers to commence filling the orders on the basis of his word alone. Indeed, he once theatrically declared that if his brash maneuvers proved illegal, he was willing to go to jail for 999 years, for he was certain that his insistence on preparedness would ultimately save his countrymen's lives. His readiness proved of paramount importance. Not unlike his cousin Theodore's preparation for conflict with Spain, contrary to the policy of President McKinley and his naval superior John Davis Long, Franklin had laid the foundation for America's entry into the Great War years in advance. After the sinking of the Lusitania in 1915 and the entrance of the United States into the war 2 years later, however, he no longer risked the charge of insubordination, but rather basked in the status of a visionary. Indeed, so successful had he been in stockpiling supplies for the Navy that an admiring President Wilson brought him into a meeting with the Army Chief of Staff and, with a twinkle in his eye, said, "I'm very sorry, but you've cornered the market for supplies. You'll have to divide up with the Army." In the end, the foresight that led Franklin to fight for his preparedness campaign redounded not only to the credit of his boss, Josephus Daniels, but to the entire Wilson administration as well. As a training run for his later leadership roles, Roosevelt's administrative experience in the Navy Department proved invaluable, developing not only his management skills, but his abilities to deal with labor. Within weeks of taking office, he visited civilian workers in the Washington Navy Yard, who had felt neglected by the Navy brass and the government over the years. "We want to get down and talk across the table with you," he told them, assuring them they could come to him at any time, with complaints, or simply, to talk things over. He delivered the same message to workers in every yard and every dock he visited, telling disgruntled American Federation of Labor machinists that his door would always be open. During his tenure as assistant secretary, there was not a single strike by the thousands of civilian workers in the Navy Department. With the Allied victory in the war, Roosevelt's tenure in the Navy Department came to a close. "My dear chief," he wrote Daniels in warm acknowledgement of the mentoring role he had played in his political education, "you have taught me so wisely and kept my feet on the ground when I was about to skyrocket." Just as chance had intervened a decade earlier when the bosses chose him to run for the state legislature, so chance played a central role in the selection of 38-year-old Franklin Roosevelt as the Democratic nominee for vice president in 1920. Roosevelt's name had not even appeared among a list of 39 potential vice presidential candidates printed in the New York Herald on the day the Democratic National Convention opened in San Francisco. By the summer of 1920, public opinion had turned against the Democrats. Woodrow Wilson had suffered a stroke and lay incapacitated in the White House. Weary of both war and progressive reform after 8 years of the Democratic administration, Americans were anxious to return to the simpler way of life promised by Republicans in their campaign slogan, "Return to Normalcy." Needless to say, a cheerless mood engulfed the party faithful. Aware that 1920 was not likely to be a Democratic year, the major figures in the party had declined to enter the fray. With no clear frontrunners, 44 ballots were taken before Governor James Cox of Ohio finally secured the presidential nomination. At this point, the vice presidential nomination seemed of small concern. The delegates were impatient to get home. Having chosen a candidate from Ohio, the bosses sought geographical balance. Franklin Roosevelt was from the critical state of New York, had carved a reputation for independence,